it's business as usual. After the meeting, tea was made, by the women, of course, and Maud sat next to Ethel, taking off her gloves to hold a cup and saucer of thick blue earthenware pottery in her soft hands. Ethel felt it would be unkind to tell Maud the truth about her brother, so she gave her the latest version of her fictional saga, that Teddy Williams had been killed fighting in France. "I tell people we were married," she said, touching the cheap ring she wore. "Not that anyone cares these days. When boys are going off to war, girls want to please them, married or not." She lowered her voice. "I don't suppose you've heard from Walter." Maud smiled. "The most amazing thing happened. You read in the newspapers about the Christmas truce." "Yes, of course. British and Germans exchanging presents and playing football in no man's land. It's a shame they didn't continue the truce and refuse to fight on." "Absolutely. But Fitz met Walter." "Well, now there's marvellous." Of course, Fitz doesn't know we're married, so Walter had to be careful what he said. "But he sent a message to say he was thinking of me on Christmas Day." Ethel squeezed Maud's hand. "So he's all right." "He's been in the fighting in East Prussia, and now he's on the front line in France, but he hasn't been wounded." "Thank heaven, but I don't suppose you'll hear from him again. Such luck doesn't repeat itself." "No. My only hope is that for some reason he'll be sent to a neutral country, such as Sweden or the United States, where he can post a letter to me. Otherwise I have to wait until the war is over." "And what about the Earl?" "Fitz is fine. He spent the first few weeks of the war living it up in Paris." "While I was looking for a job in a sweatshop," Ethel thought resentfully. Maud went on, "Princess Bea had a baby boy. Fitz must be happy to have an heir." "We're all pleased," Maud said, and Ethel remembered that she was an aristocrat as well as a rebel. The meeting broke up. A cab was waiting for Maud, and they said goodbye. Bernie Leckwith got on the bus with Ethel. "She was better than I expected," he said. "Upper class, of course, but quite sound. And friendly, especially to you. I suppose you get to know the family quite well when you're in service." "You don't know the half of it," Ethel thought. Ethel lived on a quiet street of small terraced houses, old but well-built, mostly occupied by better-off workers, craftsmen and supervisors, and their families. Bernie walked her to her front door. He probably wanted to kiss her goodnight. She toyed with the idea of letting him, just because she was grateful there was one man in the world who still found her attractive. But common sense prevailed. She did not want to give him false hope. "Good night, comrade," she said cheerfully, and she went inside. There was no sound or light upstairs. Mildred and her children were already asleep. Ethel undressed and got into bed. She was weary, but her mind was active, and she could not fall asleep. After a while, she got up and made tea. She decided to write to her brother. She opened her writing pad and began. "My very dear young sister Libby." In the childhood code, every third word counted, and familiar names were scrambled, so this meant simply, "Dear Billy." She recalled that her method had been to write out the message she wanted to send, then fill in the spaces. She now wrote, "Sitting alone, feeling proper miserable." Then she turned it into code. "Where I'm sitting, if you're alone, you're not feeling yourself either proper happy or miserable." As a child, she had loved this game, inventing an imaginary message to hide the real one. She and Billy had devised helpful tricks. Crossed out words counted, whereas underlined words did not. She decided to write out the whole of her message, then go back and turn it into code. "The streets of London are not paved with gold, at least not in Aldgate." She thought about writing a cheerful letter, making light of her troubles. Then she thought, "To hell with that. I can tell my brother the truth. I used to believe I was special, don't ask why. She thinks she's too good for Aberdeen, they used to say, and they were right." She had to blink back tears when she thought of those days. The crisp uniform, the hearty meals in the spotless servants' hall, and most of all the slim, beautiful body that had once been hers. "Now look at me. I work 12 hours a day in Manny Litoff's sweatshop. I have a headache every evening, and a permanent pain in my back. I'm having a baby no one wants. No one wants me either, except a boring librarian with glasses." She sucked the end of her pencil for a long, thoughtful moment. Then she wrote, "I might as well be dead." On the second Sunday of each month, an Orthodox priest came from Cardiff on the train up the valley to Aberowen, carrying a suitcase full of carefully wrapped icons and candlesticks to celebrate divine liturgy for the Russians. Lev Peshkov hated priests, but he always attended the service. You had to get the free dinner afterward. The service took place in the reading room of the public library. It was a Carnegie library, built with a donation from the American philanthropist, according to a plaque in the lobby. Lev could read, but he did not really understand people who thought of it as a pleasure. The newspapers here were fixed to hefty wooden holders, so that they could not be stolen, and there were signs that read, "Silence." How much fun could you have in such a place? Lev disliked most things about Aberowen. Horses were the same everywhere, but he hated working underground. It was always half dark, and the thick coal dust made him cough. Above ground it rained all the time. He had never seen so much rain. It did not come in thunderstorms or sudden cloudbursts, to be followed by the relief of clear skies and dry weather. Rather, it was a soft drizzle that drifted down all day, sometimes all week, creeping up the legs of his trousers and down the back of his shirt. The strike had petered out in August, after the outbreak of war, and the miners had drifted back to work. Most had been rehired and given back their old houses. The exceptions were those the management branded troublemakers, most of whom had gone off to join the Welsh Rifles. The evicted widows had found places to live. The strikebreakers were no longer ostracized. The locals had come round to the view that the foreigners, too, had been manipulated by the capitalist system. But it was not for this that Lev had escaped from St. Petersburg. Britain was better than Russia, of course. Trade unions were allowed. The police were not completely out of control. Even Jews were free. All the same, he was not going to settle for a life of back-breaking work in a mining town on the edge of nowhere. This was not what he and Grigori had dreamed of. This was not America. Even if he had been tempted to stay there, he owed it to Grigori to go on. He knew he had treated his brother badly, but he had sworn to send him money for his own ticket. Lev had broken a lot of promises in his short life, but he intended to keep this one. He had most of the price of a ticket from Cardiff to New York. The money was hidden under a flagstone in the kitchen of his house in Wellington Row, along with his gun and his brother's passport. He had not saved this out of his weekly wage, of course. That was barely enough to keep him in beer and tobacco. His savings came from the weekly card game. Spyria was no longer his collaborator. The young man had left Aberowen after a few days and returned to Cardiff to seek easier work. But it was never difficult to find a greedy man, and Lev had befriended a colliery deputy called Rhys Price. Lev made sure Rhys won steadily, and afterward they shared the proceeds. It was important not to overdo things. Other people had to win sometimes. If the miners worked out what was going on, not only would it be the end of the card school, but they would probably kill Lev. So the money accumulated slowly, and Lev could not afford to turn down a free meal. The priest was always met at the station by the Earl's car. He was driven to Tiguen, where he was given sherry and cake. If Princess Bear was in residence, she accompanied him to the library and entered the room a few seconds before him, which saved her having to wait too long with the common people. Today it was a few minutes after 11 by the large clock on the reading room wall when she entered, wearing a white fur coat and hat against the February cold. Lev repressed a shudder. He could not look at her without feeling again the sheer terror of a six-year-old seeing his father hanged. The priest followed in a cream-coloured robe with a gold sash. Today, for the first time, he was accompanied by another man in the garb of a novice priest, and Lev was shocked and horrified to recognise his former partner in crime, Spyria. Lev's mind was in turmoil as the two clergymen prepared the five loaves and watered the red wine for the service. Had Spyria found God and changed his ways? Or was the clerical outfit just another cover for stealing and cheating? The older priest sang the blessing. A few of the more devout men had formed a choir, a development their Welsh neighbours approved of heartily, and now they sang the first Amen. Lev crossed himself when the others did, but his mind was anxiously on Spyria. It would be just like a priest to blurt out the truth and ruin everything. No more card games. No ticket to America, no money for Grigori. Lev recalled the last day on the angel Gabriel, when he had brutally threatened to throw Spyria overboard for merely talking about double-crossing him. Spyria might well remember that now. Lev wished he had not humiliated the man. Lev studied Spyria throughout the service, trying to read his face. When he went up to the front to receive communion, he tried to catch his old friend's eye, but he saw no sign even of recognition. Spyria was totally caught up in the rite, or pretending to be. Afterward, the two clergy left in the car with the princess, and the 30 or so Russian Christians followed on foot. Lev wondered if Spyria would speak to him at Tiguen, and fretted about what he might say. Would he pretend their scam had never happened? Would he spill the beans and bring the wrath of the miners down on Lev's head? Would he demand a price for his silence? Lev was tempted to leave town immediately. There were trains to Cardiff every hour or two. If he had had more money, he might have cut and run. But he did not have enough for the ticket, so he trudged up the hill out of town to the Earl's palace for the midday dinner. They were fed in the staff quarters below stairs. The food was hearty, mutton stew with as much bread as you could eat, and ale to wash it down. The princess's middle-aged Russian maid, Nina, joined them and acted as interpreter. She had a soft spot for Lev, and made sure he got extra ale. The priest ate with the princess, but Spyria came to the servants' hall and sat next to Lev. Lev turned on his most welcoming smile.
"Well, old friend, this is a surprise," he said in Russian. "Congratulations!"
Spyria refused to be charmed.
"Are you still playing cards, my son?" he replied.
Lev kept the smile but lowered his voice.
"I'll shut up about that, if you will. Is that fair? We'll talk after dinner."
Lev was frustrated. Which way was Spyria going to jump? Righteousness or blackmail? When the meal was over, Spyria went out through the back door, and Lev followed. Without speaking, Spyria led him to a white rotunda like a miniature Greek temple. From its raised platform they could see anyone approaching. It was raining, and the water dripped down the marble pillars. Lev shook the rain off his cap and put it back on his head. Spyria said,
"Do you recall my asking you on the ship what you would do if I refused to give you your half of the money?"
Lev had pushed Spyria half over the rail and threatened to break his neck and throw his body in the sea.
"No, I don't remember," he lied.
"It doesn't matter," Spyria said.
"I simply wish to forgive you."
Righteousness, then, Lev thought with relief.
"What we did was sinful," Spyria said. "I have confessed and received absolution."
"I won't ask your priest to play cards with me, then."
"Don't joke."
Lev wanted to grab Spyria by the throat, as he had on the ship. But Spyria no longer looked as if he could be bullied. The rope had given him balls, ironically. Spyria went on,
"I ought to reveal your crime to those you robbed."
"They won't thank you. They may take revenge on you as well as me.
My priestly garments will protect me."
Lev shook his head.
"Most of the people you and I robbed were poor Jews. They probably remember priests looking on with a smile while the Cossacks beat them up. They might kick you to death all the more eagerly in your robe."
The shadow of anger passed over Spyria's young face, but he forced a benign smile.
"I'm more concerned about you, my son. I would not like to provoke violence against you."
Lev knew when he was being threatened.
"What are you going to do?"
"The question is what you're going to do."
"Will you keep your mouth shut if I stop?"
"If you confess, make a sincere contrition, and cease your sin, God will forgive you. And then it will not be for me to punish you."
"And you'll get away with it too," Lev thought.
"All right, I'll do it,"
he said. As soon as he had spoken, he realized he had given in too quickly. Spyria's next words confirmed that he was not so easily fooled.
"I will check," he said. "And if I find you have broken your promise to me and to God, I will reveal your crime to your victims,
and they will kill me."
"Good work, father. As far as I can see, it's the best way out of a moral dilemma, and my priest agrees. So take it or leave it."
"I have no choice."
"God bless you, my son," said Spyria.
Lev walked away. He left the grounds of Tiguen and headed through the rain back into Aberowen, fuming. How like a priest, he thought resentfully, to take away a man's chance of bettering himself. Spyria was comfortable now, food and clothing and accommodation all provided forever by the church, and the hungry worshippers who gave money they could not afford. For the rest of his life, Spyria would have nothing to do but sing the services and fiddle with the altar boys. What was left to do? If he gave up the card games, it would take him forever to save enough for his passage. He would be doomed to spend years tending pit ponies half a mile underground, and he would never redeem himself by sending Grigori the price of a ticket to America. He had never chosen the safe path. He made his way to the Two Crowns pub. In Sabbath-observing Wales, pubs were not allowed to open on Sundays, but the rules were lightly regarded in Aberowen. There was only one policeman in the town, and, like most people, he took Sundays off. The Two Crowns closed its front door for the sake of appearances, but regulars went in through the kitchen, and business was done as usual. At the bar were the Ponty brothers, Joey and Johnny. They were drinking whiskey, unusually. The miners drank beer. Whiskey was a rich man's potion, and a bottle probably lasted the Two Crowns from one Christmas to the next. Lev ordered a pot of beer and addressed the elder brother.
"Aye, aye, Joey."
"Aye, aye, Grigori." Lev was still using his brother's name, which was on the passport.
"Feeling flush today, Joey, is it?"
"Aye.
Me and the kid went to Cardiff yesterday for the boxing."
The brothers looked like boxers themselves, Lev thought. Two broad-shouldered, bull-necked men with big hands.
"Good, was it?" he said. "Darky Jenkins versus Roman Tony. We bet on Tony, being Italian like us. Odds of 13-1, and he knocked Jenkins out in 3 rounds.
Lev sometimes struggled with formal English, but he knew the meaning of 13-1. He said,
"You should come and play cards. You are..."
He hesitated, then remembered the phrase.
"You are making a lucky streak."
"Oh, I don't want to lose it as quick as I won it," Joey said.
However, when the card school assembled in the barn half an hour later, Joey and Johnny were there. The rest of the players were a mixture of Russian and Welsh. They played a local version of poker called three-card brag. Lev liked it. After the initial three, no further cards were dealt or exchanged, so the game went fast. If a player raised the bet, the next man in the circle had to match the raise immediately. He could not stay in the game by betting the original stake, so the pot grew quickly. Betting continued until there were only two players left, at which point one of them could end the round by doubling the previous bet, which forced his opponent to show his cards. The best hand was three of a kind, known as a prial, and the highest of all was a prial of trays, 3 threes. Lev had a natural instinct for odds, and would usually have won at cards without cheating, but that was too slow. The deal moved to the left every hand, so Lev could fix the cards only once in a while. However, there were 1,000 ways to cheat, and Lev had devised a simple code that enabled Reese to indicate when he had a good hand. Lev would then stay in the betting, regardless of what he was holding, to force the stakes up and enlarge the pot. Most of the time everyone else would drop out, and Lev would then lose to Reese. As the first hand was dealt, Lev decided this would be his last game. If he cleaned out the Ponty brothers, he would probably be able to buy his ticket. Next Sunday, Spiria would make inquiries to find out whether Lev was still running a card school. By then, Lev wanted to be at sea. Over the next 2 hours, Lev watched Reese's winnings grow, and told himself America was coming nearer with each penny. He did not usually like to clean anyone out, because he wanted them to come back next week. But today was the day to go for the jackpot. As the afternoon began to darken outside, he got the deal. He gave Joey Ponty 3 aces, and Reese 3 threes. In this game, threes beat aces. He gave himself a pair of kings, which justified him in betting high. He stayed in the betting until Joey was almost broke. He did not want to collect any IOUs. Joey used the last of his money to see Reese's hand. The expression on Joey's face when Reese showed a prial of trays was both comical and pitiful. Reese raked the money in. Lev stood up and said, "I'm cleaned out." The game broke up and they all returned to the bar, where Reese bought a round of drinks to soothe the feelings of the losers. The Ponty brothers reverted to drinking beer, and Joey said, "Ah, well, easy come, easy go, isn't it?" A few minutes later, Lev went back outside and Reese followed. There was no toilet at the Two Crowns, so the men used the lane at the back of the barn. The only illumination came from a distant streetlight. Reese quickly handed Lev his half of the winnings, partly in coins and partly in the new coloured banknotes, green for £1 and brown for 10 shillings. Lev knew exactly what he was owed. Arithmetic came naturally to him, like figuring the odds at cards.
He would count the money later, but he was sure Rhys would not cheat him. The man had tried, once. Lev had found his share to be 5 shillings short, an amount that a careless man might have overlooked. Lev had gone to Rhys's house, stuck the barrel of his revolver into the man's mouth, and cocked the hammer. Rhys had soiled himself in fear. After that, the money had always been correct to a halfpenny. Lev stuffed the money into his coat pocket, and they returned to the bar. As they walked in, Lev saw Spiria. He had taken off his robes and put on the overcoat he had worn on the ship. He stood at the bar, not drinking, but talking earnestly to a small group of Russians, including some of the card school. Momentarily, he met Lev's eye. Lev turned on his heel and went out, but he knew he was too late. He walked quickly away, heading up the hill to Wellington Row. Spiria would betray him, he felt sure. Even now he might be explaining how Lev managed to cheat at cards and yet seen the loser. The men would be furious, and the Ponty brothers would want their money back. As he approached his house, he saw a man coming the other way with a suitcase, and in the lamplight he recognized a young neighbor known as Billy with Jesus. "Ayay, Billy," he said. "Ayay, Grigori." The boy looked as if he was leaving town, and Lev was curious. "Off somewhere?" "London." Lev's interest quickened. "What train?" 6 o'clock to Cardiff." Passengers for London had to change trains at Cardiff. "What is it now?" 22. "So long, then." Lev went into his house. He would catch the same train as Billy, he decided. He turned on the electric light in the kitchen and lifted the flagstone. He took out his savings, the passport with his brother's name and photograph, a box of brass bullets, and his gun. An Agant M1895 he had won from an army captain in a card game. He checked the cylinder to make sure there was a live round in each chamber. Used rounds were not automatically ejected, but had to be removed manually when reloading. He put the money, the passport and the gun in the pockets of his coat. Upstairs he found Grigori's cardboard suitcase with the bullet hole. Into it he packed the ammunition, plus his other shirt, his spare underwear, and 2 packs of cards. He had no watch, but he calculated that 5 minutes had passed since he saw Billy. That gave him 15 minutes to walk to the station, which was enough. From the street outside he heard the voices of several men. He did not want a confrontation. He was tough, but the miners were too. Even if he won the fight, he would miss his train. He could use the gun, of course, but in this country the police were serious about catching murderers, even when the victims were nobodies. At a minimum, they would check the passengers at the docks in Cardiff and make it difficult for him to buy a ticket. In every way, it would be best if he could leave town without violence. He went out of the back door and hurried along the lane, walking as quietly as he could in his heavy boots. The ground underfoot was muddy, as it almost always was in Wales, so fortunately his footsteps made little noise. At the end of the lane he turned down an alley and emerged into the lights of the street. The toilets in the middle of the road shielded him from the view of anyone outside his house. He hurried away. 2 streets farther on he realized that his route took him past the 2 Crowns. He stopped and thought for a moment. He knew the layout of the town, and the only alternative route would require him to double back. But the men whose voices he had heard might still be near his house. He had to risk the 2 Crowns. He turned down another alley and took the back lane that passed behind the pub. As he approached the barn where they had played cards, he heard voices and glimpsed 2 or more men, dimly outlined by the street lamp at the far end of the lane. He was running out of time, but all the same, he stopped and waited for them to go back inside. He stood close to a high wooden fence to make himself less visible. They seemed to take forever. "Come on," he whispered. "Don't you want to get back into the warm?" The rain dripped off his cap and down the back of his neck. At last they went inside, and Lev emerged from the shadows and hurried forward. He passed the barn without incident, but as he drew away from it, he heard more voices. He cursed. The customers had been drinking beer since midday, and by this time of the afternoon they needed frequent visits to the lane. He heard someone call after him, "Aye, aye, butty!" Their word for friend was butty or butt. Its use meant he had not been recognized. He pretended not to hear, and walked on. He could hear a murmured conversation. Most of the words were unintelligible, but he thought one man said, "Looks like a Ruski." Russian clothes were different from British, and Lev guessed they might be able to make out the cut of his coat and the shape of his cap by the light of the street lamp, which he was quickly approaching. However, the call of nature was usually urgent for men coming out of a pub, and he thought they would not follow him before they had relieved themselves. He turned down the next alley and disappeared from their view. Unfortunately, he doubted whether he had gone from their minds. Spiria must by now have told his story, and someone would soon realize the significance of a man in Russian clothes walking toward the town center with a suitcase in his hand. He had to be on that train. He broke into a run. The railway line lay in the cleft of the valley, so the way to the station was all downhill. Lev ran easily, taking long strides. He could see, over the rooftops, the lights of the station and, as he came closer, the smoke from the funnel of a train standing at the platform. He ran across the square and into the booking hall. The hands of the big clock stood at 6:01. He hurried to the ticket window and fished money from his pocket. "Ticket, please," he said. "Where would you like to go this evening?" the clerk said pleasantly. Lev pointed urgently to the platform. "That train by there. This train calls at Aberdare, Pontypridd, Cardiff." Lev glanced up and saw the minute hand click through its last segment and stop, trembling slightly, at the o'clock position. "Single or return?" said the clerk unhurriedly. "Single, quickly." Lev heard the whistle. Desperately, he looked through the coins in his hand. He knew the fare. He had been to Cardiff twice in the last 6 months, and he put the money on the counter. The train began to move. The clerk gave him his ticket. Lev grabbed it and turned away. "Don't forget your change," said the clerk. Lev strode the few paces to the barrier. "Ticket, please," said the collector, even though he had just watched Lev buy it. Looking past the barrier, Lev saw the train gathering speed. The collector punched his ticket and said, "Don't you want your change?" The door of the booking hall burst open, and the Ponty brothers rushed in. "There you are!" Joey cried, and he rushed at Lev. Lev surprised him by stepping toward him and punching him directly in the face. Joey was stopped in his tracks. Johnny crashed into his older brother's back, and both fell to their knees. Lev snatched his ticket from the collector and ran onto the platform. The train was moving quite fast. He ran alongside it for a moment. Suddenly a door opened, and Lev saw the friendly face of Billy with Jesus. Billy shouted, "Jump!" Lev leaped for the train and got one foot on the step. Billy grabbed his arm. They teetered for a moment as Lev tried desperately to haul himself aboard. Then Billy gave a heave and pulled Lev inside. He sank gratefully into a seat. Billy pulled the door shut and sat opposite him. "Thank you," Lev said. "You cut it fine," Billy said. "I made it though," said Lev with a grin. "That's all that counts." 3. At Paddington Station next morning, Billy asked for directions to Aldgate. A friendly Londoner gave him a rapid stream of detailed instructions, every word of which he found completely incomprehensible. He thanked the man and walked out of the station. He had never been to London, but he knew that Paddington was in the west, and poor people lived in the east, so he walked toward the mid-morning sun. The city was even bigger than he had imagined, a great deal busier and more confusing than Cardiff, but he relished it. The noise, the rushing traffic, the crowds, and most of all the shops. He had not known there were so many shops in the world. How much was spent in London's shops every day, he wondered. It must be thousands of pounds, maybe millions. He felt a sense of freedom that was quite heady. No one here knew him. In Aberowen, or even on his occasional trips to Cardiff, he was always liable to be observed by friends or relations. In London, he might walk along a street holding hands with a pretty girl, and his parents would never find out. He had no intention of doing so, but the thought that he could, and the fact that there were so many pretty, well-dressed girls walking around, was intoxicating. After a while he saw a bus with Aldgate written on its front, and he jumped aboard. Ethel's letter had mentioned Aldgate. When he decoded her letter, he had been very worried. Of course, he could not discuss it with his parents. He had waited until they left for the evening service at the Bethesda Chapel, which he no longer attended. Then he had written a note. "Dear Mum, I am worried about Tareth and have gone to find her. Sorry to sneak off, but I don't want a row. Your loving son, Billy." As it was Sunday, He was already bathed and shaved and dressed in his best clothes. His suit was a shabby hand-me-down from his father, but he had a clean white shirt and a black knitted tie. He had dozed in the waiting room at Cardiff Station and caught the milk train in the early hours of Monday morning. The bus conductor alerted him when they reached Aldgate, and he got off. It was a poor neighbourhood with crumbling slum houses, street stalls selling second-hand clothes, and barefoot children playing in noisome stairwells. He did not know where Ethel lived. Her letter had not given an address. His only clue was, "I work 12 hours a day in Manny Litoff's sweatshop." He looked forward to giving Eth all the news from Aberowen. She would know from the newspapers that the widow strike had failed. Billy seethed when he thought of it. The bosses were able to behave outrageously because they held all the cards. They owned the mines and the houses, and they acted as if they owned the people. Because of various complex franchise rules, most miners did not have the vote, so Aberowen's Member of Parliament was a Conservative who invariably sided with the company. Tommy Griffiths's father said nothing would ever change without a revolution, like the one they had had in France. Billy's da said they needed a Labour government. Billy did not know who was right. He went up to a friendly-looking young man and said, "Do you know the way to Manny Litoff's place?" The man replied in a language that sounded like Russian. He tried again, and this time got an English speaker who had never heard of Manny Litoff. Aldgate was not like Aberowen, where everyone on the street would know the way to every place of business in town. Had he come this far and spent all that money on his train ticket for nothing? He was not yet ready to give up. He scanned the busy street for British-looking people who seemed to be about some kind of business, carrying tools or pushing carts. He questioned 5 more people without success, then came across a window cleaner with a ladder. "Manny Litoff's," the man repeated. He managed to say Litoff without pronouncing the letter T, instead making a noise in his throat like a small cough. "Clovin factory." "Pardon me," Billy said politely. "What was that again?" "Clovin factory. Place where they makes clovin. Jackets and trousers and it."
Probably, yes," Billy said, feeling desperate.
The window cleaner nodded.
"Straight on. 1/4 mile. Do a right. Outgrove Road."
"Straight on," Billy replied. 1/4 mile.
"That's it. Then do a right.
Turn right.
Outgrove Road."
"Outgrove Road. Can't miss it." The street name turned out to be Outgrove Road. It had no grove of anything, let alone oaks. It was a narrow, winding lane of dilapidated brick buildings, busy with people, horses, and handcarts. 2 more inquiries brought Billy to a house squashed between the Dog and Duck pub and a boarded-up shop called Lipman's. The front door stood open. Billy climbed the stairs to the top floor, where he found himself in a room with about 20 women sewing British Army uniforms. They continued working, operating their treadles, taking no apparent notice of him, until eventually one said,
"Come in, love. We won't eat you. Although, come to think of it, I might try a little taste."
They all cackled with laughter.
"I'm looking for Ethel Williams," he said.
"She's not here," the woman said.
"Why not?" he said anxiously. "Is she ill?"
"What business is it of yours?"
The woman got up from her machine.
"I'm Mildred. Who are you?"
Billy stared at her. She was pretty, even though she had buck teeth. She wore bright red lipstick and fair curls poked out from under her hat. She was wrapped in a thick, shapeless grey coat, but despite that, he could see the sway of her hips as she walked toward him. He was too taken with her to speak. She said,
"You're not the bastard who put her up the daft and scarpered, are you?"
Billy found his voice.
"I'm her brother."
"Oh," she said. "Fucking hell. Are you Billy?"
Billy's jaw dropped. He had never heard a woman use that word.
She scrutinized him with a fearless gaze.
"You are her brother. I can see it. Now you look older than 16.
Her tone softened in a way that made him feel warm inside.
"You've got the same dark eyes and curly hair."
"Where can I find her?" he said.
She gave him a challenging look.
"I happen to know that she doesn't want her family to find out where she's living."
"She's scared of my father," Billy said. "But she wrote me a letter. I was worried about her, so I came up on the train."
"All the way from that dump in Wales where she's from?"
"It's not a dump," Billy said indignantly. Then he shrugged and said, "Well, it is really, I suppose."
"I love your accent," Mildred said. "To me it's like hearing someone sing.
Do you know where she lives?"
How did you find this place?
She said she worked at Manny Litoff's in Aldgate.
Well, you're Sherlock bloody Holmes, aren't you?
She said, not without a note of reluctant admiration. If you don't tell me where she is, someone else will, he said with more confidence than he felt. I'm not going home till I've seen her.
She'll kill me, but all right, Mildred said. 23 Natalie Street.
Billy asked her for directions. He made her speak slowly.
Don't thank me, she said as he took his leave. Just protect me if Ethel tries to kill me.
All right, then, said Billy, thinking how thrilling it would be to protect Mildred from something. The other women shouted goodbye and blew kisses as he left, embarrassing him. Nutley Street was an oasis of quiet. The terraced houses were built to a pattern that had become familiar to Billy after only one day in London. They were much larger than miners' cottages, with small front yards instead of a door opening onto the street. The effect of order and regularity was created by identical sash windows, each with 12 panes of glass, in rows, all along the terrace. He knocked at number 23, but no one answered. He was worried. Why had she not gone to work? Was she ill? If not, why was she not at home? He peered through the letterbox and saw a hallway with polished floorboards and a hat stand bearing an old brown coat that he recognized. It was a cold day. Ethel would not go out without her coat. He stepped close to the window and tried to look inside, but he could not see through the net curtain. He returned to the door and looked through the flap again. The scene inside was unchanged, but this time he heard a noise. It was a long, agonized groan. He put his mouth to the letterbox and shouted, "Eth, is that you? It's Billy out here." There was a long silence. Then the groan was repeated. "Bloody hell," he said. The door had a Yale-type lock. That meant the catch was probably attached to the doorpost with two screws. He struck the door with the heel of his hand. It did not seem particularly stout, and he guessed the wood was cheap pine, many years old. He leaned back, lifted his right leg, and kicked the door with the heel of his heavy miner's boot. There was a sound of splintering. He kicked several more times, but the door did not open. He wished he had a hammer. He looked up and down the road, hoping to see a workman with tools, but the street was deserted except for two dirty-faced boys who were watching him with interest. He walked down the short garden path to the gate, turned, and ran at the door, hitting it with his right shoulder. It burst open and he fell inside. He picked himself up, rubbing his hurt shoulder, and pushed the ruined door to. The house seemed silent. "Eth," he called, "where are you?" The groaning came again, and he followed the sound into the front room on the ground floor. It was a woman's bedroom, with china ornaments on the mantelpiece and flowered curtains at the window. Ethel was on the bed, wearing a grey dress that covered her like a tent. She was not lying down, but on her hands and knees, groaning. "What's wrong with you, Eth?" said Billy, and his voice came out as a terrified squeak. She caught her breath. "The baby's coming. Oh, well, I'd better fetch a doctor. Too late, Billy. Dear Jesus, it hurts. You sound like you're dying. No, Billy, this is what childbirth is like. Come by here and hold my hand." Billy knelt by the bed, and Ethel took his hand. She tightened her grip and began to groan again. The groan was longer and more agonized than before, and she gripped his hand so hard he thought she might break a bone. Her groan ended with a shriek, then she panted as if she had run a mile. After a minute she said, "I'm sorry, Billy, but you're going to have to look up my skirt." "Oh," he said, "oh, right." He did not really understand, but he thought he had better do as he was told. He lifted the hem of Ethel's dress. "Oh, Christ," he said. The bedsheet beneath her was soaked in blood. There in the middle of it was a tiny pink thing covered in slime. He made out a big round head with closed eyes, two tiny arms, and two legs.
"It's a baby," he said.
"Pick it up, Billy," said Ethel.
"What? Me?"
he said.
"Oh, right then."
He leaned over the bed. He got one hand under the baby's head, and one under its little bum. It was a boy, he saw. The baby was slippery and slimy, but Billy managed to pick him up. There was a cord still attaching him to Ethel.
"Have you got it?"
she said.
"Aye,"
he said.
"I've got him. It's a boy. Is he breathing?"
"I don't know.
How can you tell?"
Billy fought down panic.
"No, he's not breathing, I don't think.
Smack his bum, not too hard."
Billy turned the baby over, held him easily in one hand, and sharply smacked his bottom. Immediately the child opened his mouth, breathed in, and yelled in protest. Billy was delighted.
"Ark at that," he said. "Hold him a minute while I turn over."
Ethel got herself into a sitting position and straightened her dress.
"Give him to me."
Billy carefully handed him over. Ethel held the baby in the crook of her arm and wiped his face with her sleeve.
"He's beautiful,"
she said. Billy was not so sure about that. The cord attached to the baby's navel had been blue and taut, but now it shriveled and turned pale. Ethel said,
"Open that drawer, over by there, and pass me the scissors and a reel of cotton."
Ethel tied two knots in the cord, then snipped it between the knots.
"There,"
she said. She unbuttoned the front of her dress.
"I don't suppose you'll be embarrassed after what you've seen,"
she said, and she took out a breast and put the nipple to the baby's mouth. He began to suck. She was right. Billy was not embarrassed. An hour ago he would have been mortified by the sight of his sister's bare breast, but such a feeling seemed trivial now. All he felt was enormous relief that the baby was all right. He stared, watching him suckle, marveling at the tiny fingers. He felt as if he had witnessed a miracle. His face was wet with tears, and he wondered when he had cried. He had no memory of doing so. Quite soon the baby fell asleep. Ethel buttoned her dress.
"We'll wash him in a minute," she said.
Then she closed her eyes.
"My God," she said, "I didn't know it was going to hurt that much."
Billy said,
"Who's his father, Eth?"
"Earl Fitzherbert," she said,
and she opened her eyes.
"Oh, bugger, I never meant to tell you that."
"The bloody swine," said Billy. "I'll kill him."
Chapter 15. June to September 1915. As the ship entered New York Harbor, it occurred to Lev Peshkov that America might not be as wonderful as his brother Grigory said. He steeled himself for a terrible disappointment. But that was unnecessary. America was all the things he had hoped for. Rich, busy, exciting, and free. 3 months later, on a hot afternoon in June, he was working at a hotel in Buffalo, in the stables, grooming a guest's horse. The place was owned by Joseph Vyalov, who had put an onion dome on top of the old Central Tavern and renamed it the St. Petersburg Hotel, perhaps out of nostalgia for the city he had left when he was a child. Lev worked for Vyalov, as did many of Buffalo's Russian immigrants, but he had never met the man. If he ever did, he was not sure what he would say. The Vyalov family in Russia had cheated Lev by dumping him in Cardiff, and that rankled. On the other hand, the paper supplied by the St. Petersburg Vyalovs had got Lev through U.S. immigration without a hitch, and mentioning the name of Vyalov in a bar on Canal Street had got him a job immediately. He had been speaking English every day for a year now, ever since he landed in Cardiff, and he was becoming fluent. Americans said he had a British accent, and they were not familiar with some of the expressions he had learned in Aberowen, such as "by her" and "by there," or "is it" and "isn't it" at the ends of sentences. But he could say just about anything he needed to, and girls were charmed when he called them "my lovely." At a few minutes to 6 o'clock, shortly before he finished work for the day, his friend Nick came into the stable yard, a cigarette between his lips. "Fatima brand," he said. He drew in smoke with exaggerated satisfaction. "Turkish tobacco. Beautiful." Nick's full name was Nikolai Davidovich Fomek, but here he was called Nick Foreman. He occasionally played the role previously taken by Spiria and Rhys Price in Lev's card games, though mostly he was a thief.
"How much?" said Lev.
"In the stores, 50 cents for a tin of 100 cigarettes. For you, 10 cents. Sell them for a quarter." Lev knew that Fatima was a popular brand. It would be easy to sell them at half price. He looked around the yard. The boss was nowhere to be seen.
"All right. How many do you want? I've got a trunk full."
Lev had $1 in his pocket.
20 tins, he said. "I'll give you $1 now and $1 later. I don't give credit."
Lev grinned and put his hand on Nick's shoulder.
"Come on, buddy. You can trust me. Are we pals or not?"
20 it is. I'll be right back.
Lev found an old feed sack in a corner. Nick returned with 20 long green tins, each with a picture of a veiled woman on the lid. Lev put the tins in the sack and gave Nick $1.
Always nice to give a helping hand to a fellow Russian, Nick said, and he sauntered away. Lev cleaned his curry comb and hoofpick. At 6:05, he said goodbye to the chief ostler and headed for the first ward. He felt a little conspicuous, carrying a feed sack through the streets, and he wondered what he would say if a cop stopped him and demanded to see what was in the sack. But he was not very worried. He could talk his way out of most situations. He went to a large, popular bar called the Irish Rover. He pushed through the crowd, bought a tankard of beer, and downed half of it thirstily. Then he sat next to a group of working men speaking a mixture of Polish and English. After a few moments, he said, "Anyone here smoke Fatimas?" A bald man in a leather apron said, "Yeah, I smoke a Fatima now and again. Want to buy a tin at half price? 25 cents for 100 smokes. What's wrong with them? They got lost. Someone found them. Sounds a little risky. I'll tell you what. Put your money on the table. I won't pick it up until you tell me to." The men were interested now. The bald man fished in his pocket and came up with a quarter. Lev took a tin from his sack and handed it over. The man opened the tin. He took out a small rectangle of folded paper and opened it to disclose a photograph. "Hey, it's even got a baseball card," he said. He put one of the cigarettes in his mouth and lit it. "All right," he said to Lev. "Pick up your quarter." Another man was watching over Lev's shoulder. "How much?" he said. Lev told him, and he bought 2 tins. In the next half hour, Lev sold all the cigarettes. He was pleased. He had turned $2 into 5 in less than an hour. At work, it took him a day and a half to earn $3. Maybe he would buy some more stolen tins from Nick tomorrow. He bought another beer, drank it, and went out, leaving the empty sack on the floor. Outside, he turned toward the Lovejoy district, a poor neighborhood of Buffalo where most of the Russians lived, along with many Italians and Poles. He could buy a steak on the way home and fry it with potatoes, or he could pick up Marga and take her dancing, or he could buy a new suit. He ought to save it toward Grigori's fare to America, he thought, guiltily knowing he would do no such thing. $3 was a drop in the bucket. What he needed was a really big score. Then he could send Grigori the money all in one go, before he was tempted to spend it. He was startled out of his reverie by a tap on his shoulder. His heart gave a guilty leap. He turned, half expecting to see a police uniform. But the person who had stopped him was no cop. He was a heavily built man in overalls, with a broken nose and an aggressive scowl. Lev tensed. Such a man had only one function. The man said, "Who told you to sell smokes in the Irish Rover?" "I'm just trying to make a few bucks," Lev said with a smile. "I hope I didn't offend anyone." "Was it Nicky Foreman? I heard Nick knocked over a truckload of cigarettes." Lev was not going to give that information to a stranger. "I never met anyone by that name," he said, still using a pleasant tone of voice. "Don't you know the Irish Rover belongs to Mr. V?" Lev felt a surge of anger. Mr. V had to be Joseph Vyalov. He dropped the conciliatory tone. "So put up a sign. You don't sell stuff in Mr. V's bar unless he tells you." Lev shrugged. "I didn't know that." "Here's something to help you remember," the man said, and he swung his fist. Lev was expecting the blow, and he stepped back sharply. The thug's arm swept through empty space, and he staggered, off balance. Lev stepped forward and kicked him in the shin. A fist was a poor weapon, generally, nowhere near as hard as a booted foot. Lev kicked as powerfully as he could, but it was not enough to break a bone. The man roared with anger, swung again and missed again. There was no point hitting such a man in the face. He had probably lost all feeling there. Lev kicked him in the groin. Both his hands went to his crotch, and he gasped for breath, bending forward. Lev kicked him in the stomach. The man opened and closed his mouth like a goldfish, unable to breathe. Lev stepped to one side and kicked the man's legs from under him. He went down on his back. Lev aimed carefully and kicked his knee, so that when he got up, he would not be able to move fast. Panting with exertion, he said, "Tell Mr. V he should be more polite." He walked away, breathing hard. Behind him he heard someone say, "Hey, Ilya, what the fuck happened?" 2 streets away, his breathing eased and his heartbeat slowed. To hell with Joseph Vyalov, he thought. The bastard cheated me and I won't be bullied. Vyalov would not know who had beaten up Ilya. No one in the Irish Rover knew Lev. Vyalov might get mad, but there was nothing he could do about it.
Lev started to feel elated. I put Ilya on the ground, he thought, and there's not a mark on me. He still had a pocket full of money. He stopped to buy two steaks and a bottle of gin. He lived on a street of dilapidated brick houses subdivided into small apartments. Outside the house next door, Marga was sitting on the stoop filing her nails. She was a pretty black-haired Russian girl of about 19 with a sexy grin. She worked as a waitress but hoped for a career as a singer. He had bought her drinks a couple of times and kissed her once. She had kissed him back enthusiastically. "Hi, kid," he shouted. "Who are you calling a kid? What are you doing tonight?" "I've got a date," she said. Lev did not necessarily believe her. She would never admit that she had nothing to do. "Throw him over," he said. "He has bad breath." She grinned. "You don't even know who it is. Come and see me." He hefted his paper bag. "I'm cooking steak. I'll think about it. Bring ice." He went into his building. His apartment was a low-rent place, by American standards, but it seemed spacious and luxurious to Lev. It had a bed-sitting room and a kitchen with running water and electric light, and he had it all to himself. In St. Petersburg, such an apartment would have housed 10 or more people. He took off his jacket, rolled up his sleeves, and washed his hands and face at the kitchen sink. He hoped Marga would come. She was his kind of girl, always ready to laugh or dance or have a party, never worrying too much about the future. He peeled and sliced some potatoes, then put a frying pan on the hot plate and dropped in a lump of lard. While the potatoes were frying, Marga came in with a tankard of chipped ice. She made drinks with gin and sugar. Lev sipped his drink, then kissed her lightly on the lips. "Tastes good," he said. "You're fresh," she said, but it was not a serious protest. He began to wonder if he might get her into bed later. He started to fry the steaks. "I'm impressed," she said. "Not many guys can cook." "My father died when I was 6 and my mother when I was 11," Lev said. "I was raised by my brother, Grigori. We learned to do everything for ourselves. Not that we ever had steak in Russia." She asked him about Grigori, and he told her his life story over dinner. Most girls were touched by the tale of two motherless boys struggling to get by, working in a huge locomotive factory, and renting space in a bed. He guiltily omitted the part of the story where he abandoned his pregnant girlfriend. They had their second drink in the bed sitting room. By the time they started on the third, it was getting dark outside, and she was sitting on his lap. Between sips, Lev kissed her. When she opened her mouth to his tongue, he put his hand on her breast. At that moment, the door burst open. Marga screamed. 3 men walked in. Marga jumped off Lev's lap, still screaming. One of the men hit her backhanded across the mouth and said, "Shut the fuck up, bitch." She ran for the door, both hands to her bleeding lips. They let her go. Lev sprang to his feet and lashed out at the man who had hit Marga. He got in one good punch, striking the man over the eye. Then the other two grabbed his arms. They were strong men and he could not break free. While they held him, the first man, who seemed to be their leader, punched him in the mouth, then in the stomach, several times. He spat blood and vomited his steak. When he was weakened and in agony, they frog-marched him down the stairs and out of the building. A blue Hudson stood at the curb with its engine running. They threw him onto the floor in the back. 2 of them sat with their feet on him, and the other got in the front and drove. He was in too much pain to think about where they were going. He assumed these men worked for Vyalov, but how had they found him, and what were they going to do with him? He tried not to give in to fear. After a few minutes, the car stopped, and he was hauled out. They were outside a warehouse. The street was deserted and dark. He could smell the lake, so he knew they were near the waterfront. It was a good place to murder someone, he thought with grim fatalism. There would be no witnesses, and the body could go into Lake Erie, tied inside a sack, with a few bricks to make sure it sank to the bottom. They dragged him into the building. He tried to pull himself together. This was the worst scrape he had ever been in. He was not sure he could talk his way out of it. "Why do I do these things?" he asked himself. The warehouse was full of new tires, piled 15 or 20 high. They took him through the stacks to the back and stopped outside a door that was guarded by yet another heavy-set man, who held up an arm to stop them. No words were spoken. After a minute, Lev said, "Seems we have a few minutes to wait. Anybody got a pack of cards?" No one even smiled. Eventually the door opened and Nick Foreman came out. His upper lip was swollen and one eye was closed. When he saw Lev, he said,
"I had to do it. They would have killed me."
So, Lev thought, they found me through Nick. A thin man in spectacles came to the door of the office. Surely this could not be Vyalov, Lev thought. He was too weedy. "Bring him in, Teo," he said. "Sure thing, Mr. Nile," said the leader of the thugs. The office reminded Lev of the peasant hut in which he had been born. It was too warm and the air was full of smoke. In a corner was a little table with icons of saints. Behind a steel desk sat a middle-aged man with unusually broad shoulders. He wore an expensive-looking lounge suit with a collar and tie, and there were two rings on the hand that held his cigarette. He said,
"What is that fucking smell?"
"I'm sorry, Mr. V, it's puke," said Theo. "He acted up and we had to calm him down a little. Then he lunged up his lunch."
"Let him go."
They released Lev's arms, but stayed near. Mr. V looked at him.
"I got your message," he said, "telling me I should be more polite."
Lev summoned his courage. He was not going to die sniveling. He said,
"Are you Joseph Vyalov? By Christ, you've got some nerve," the man said, "asking me who I am. I've been looking for you."
"You have been looking for me?"
"The Vyalov family sold me a ticket from St. Petersburg to New York, then dumped me in Cardiff," Lev said. "So, I want my money back."
Vyalov stared at him for a long moment, then he laughed.
"I can't help it," he said. "I like you."
Lev held his breath. Did this mean Vyalov was not going to kill him?
"Do you have a job?" Vyalov said. "I work for you."
"Where?"
"At the Hotel St. Petersburg, in the stables."
Vyalov nodded.
"I think we can offer you something better than that," he said.
2. In June 1915, America came one step closer to war. Gus Duer was appalled. He did not think the United States should join in the European War. The American people felt the same, and so did President Woodrow Wilson. But somehow the danger loomed closer. The crisis came about in May when a German submarine torpedoed the Lusitania, a British ship carrying 173 tons of rifles, ammunition, and shrapnel shells. It also carried 2,000 passengers, including 128 U.S. citizens. Americans were as shocked as if there had been an assassination. The newspapers went into convulsions of indignation.
"People are asking you to do the impossible," Gus said indignantly to the president, standing in the Oval Office. "They want you to get tough with the Germans, but not risk going to war."
Wilson nodded agreement. Looking up from his typewriter, he said,
"There's no rule that says public opinion has to be consistent."
Gus found his boss's calm admirable, but a bit frustrating.
"How the heck do you deal with that?"
Wilson smiled, showing his bad teeth.
"Gus, did someone tell you politics was easy?"
In the end, Wilson sent a stern note to the German government, demanding that they stop attacking shipping. He and his advisers, including Gus, hoped the Germans would agree to some compromise. But if they decided to be defiant, Gus did not see how Wilson could avoid escalation. It was a dangerous game to play, and Gus found he was not able to remain as coolly detached about the risk as Wilson appeared to be. While the diplomatic telegrams crossed the Atlantic, Wilson went to his summer place in New Hampshire, and Gus went to Buffalo, where he stayed at his parents' mansion on Delaware Avenue. His father had a house in Washington, but Gus lived in his own apartment there, and when he came home to Buffalo, he relished the comforts of a house run by his mother. The silver bowl of cut roses on his nightstand, the hot rolls at breakfast, the crisp white linen tablecloth fresh at every meal. The way a suit would appear sponged and pressed in his wardrobe without his having noticed that it had been taken away. The house was furnished in a consciously plain manner, his mother's reaction against the ornate fashions of her parents' generation. Much of the furniture was Biedermeier, a utilitarian German style that was enjoying a revival. The dining room had one good painting on each of the four walls, and a single three-branched candlestick on the table. At lunch, on the first day, his mother said, "I suppose you're planning to go to the slums and watch prize fights?" "There's nothing wrong with boxing," Gus said. It was his great enthusiasm. He had even tried it himself, as a foolhardy 18-year-old. His long arms had given him a couple of victories, but he lacked the killer instinct. "So, canaille," she said disdainfully. This was a snobby expression she had picked up in Europe that meant low class. "I'd like to take my mind off international politics, if I can. There's a lecture on Titian with magic lantern slides at the Albright this afternoon," she said. The Albright Art Gallery, a white, classical building set in Delaware Park, was one of Buffalo's most important cultural institutions. Gus had grown up surrounded by Renaissance paintings, and he particularly liked Titian's portraits, but he was not very interested in going to a lecture. However, it was just the kind of event to be patronized by the city's wealthy young men and women, so there was a good chance he would be able to renew old friendships. The Albright was a short drive up Delaware Avenue. He entered the pillared atrium and took a seat. As he had expected, there were several people he knew in the audience. He found himself sitting next to a strikingly pretty girl who seemed familiar. He smiled vaguely at her, and she said brightly, "You've forgotten who I am, haven't you, Mr. Dewar?" He felt foolish. I've been out of town for a while. I'm Olga Vyalov." She held out a white-gloved hand. "Of course," he said. Her father was a Russian immigrant whose first job had been throwing drunks out of a bar on Canal Street. Now he owned Canal Street. He was a city councillor and a pillar of the Russian Orthodox Church. Gus had met Olga several times, though he did not remember her looking quite so enchanting. Perhaps she had suddenly grown up or something. She was about 20, he guessed, with pale skin and blue eyes, and she wore a pink jacket with a turned-up collar and a cloche hat with pink silk flowers. "I hear you're working for the president," she said. "What do you think of Mr. Wilson?" "I admire him enormously," Gus replied. "He's a practical politician who hasn't abandoned his ideals." "How exciting to be at the center of power." "It is exciting, but strangely enough, it doesn't feel like the center of power. In a democracy, the president is subject to the voters." "But surely he doesn't just do what the public wants." "Not exactly, no. President Wilson says a leader must treat public opinion the way a sailor deals with the wind, using it to blow the ship in one direction or another, but never trying to go directly against it." She sighed. "I would have loved to study these things, but my father wouldn't let me go to college." Gus grinned. "I suppose he thinks you would learn to smoke cigarettes and drink gin." "And worse, I have no doubt," she said. It was a risque remark for an unmarried woman, and the surprise must have shown on his face, for she said, "I'm sorry I've shocked you." "Not at all." In fact, he was feeling captivated. To keep her talking, he said, "What would you study if you could go to college?"
"History, I think."
"I love history."
"Any particular period?"
"I'd like to understand my own past. Why did my father have to leave Russia? Why is America so much better? There must be reasons for these things."
"Exactly."
Gus was thrilled that such a pretty girl should also share his intellectual curiosity. He saw a sudden vision of them as a married couple, in her dressing room after a party, talking about world affairs while they got ready for bed, himself in pajamas, sitting and watching, while she unhurriedly took off her jewelry and slipped out of her clothes. Then he caught her eye and got the feeling that she had guessed what he was thinking, and he felt embarrassed. He searched for something to say, but found himself tongue-tied. Then the lecturer arrived, and the audience fell silent. He enjoyed the talk more than he had expected. The speaker had made autochrome color transparencies of some of Titian's canvases, and his magic lantern projected them onto a big white screen. When it was over, he wanted to talk some more to Olga, but he was prevented. Chuck Dixon, a man he knew from school, came up to them. Chuck had an easy charm that Gus envied. They were the same age, 25, but Chuck made Gus feel like an awkward schoolboy.
"Olga, you have to meet my cousin," he said jovially. "He's been staring at you across the room."
He smiled amiably at Gus. "Sorry to deprive you of such bewitching company, Dewar, but you can't have her all afternoon, you know."
He put a possessive arm around Olga's waist and led her away. Gus felt bereft. He had been getting on so well with her, he felt. For him, those first conversations with a girl were usually the hardest, but with Olga, small talk had seemed easy. And now Chuck Dixon, who had always been bottom of the class at school, had just walked away with her as easily as he would have taken a drink from a waiter's tray. While Gus was looking around for someone else he knew, he was approached by a girl with one eye. The first time he met Rosa Hellman, at a fundraising dinner for the Buffalo Symphony Orchestra, in which her brother played, he thought she was winking at him. In fact, one eye was permanently closed. Her face was otherwise pretty, which made her disfigurement more striking. Furthermore, she always dressed stylishly, as if in defiance. Today she wore a straw boater set at a jaunty angle and managed to look cute. Last time he saw her, she had been the editor of a small circulation radical newspaper called The Buffalo Anarchist, and Gus said, "Are anarchists interested in art?" "I work for the Evening Advertiser now," she said. Gus was surprised. "Does the editor know about your political views?" "My views aren't quite as extreme as they used to be, but he knows my history." I guess he figured that if you can make a success of an anarchist newspaper, you must be good. "He says he gave me the job because I have more balls than any two of his male reporters." Gus knew she liked to shock, but even so, his mouth dropped open. Rosa laughed, "but he still sends me to cover art exhibitions and fashion shows." She changed the subject. "What's it like working in the White House?" Gus was conscious that anything he said might appear in her paper. "Tremendously exciting," he said. "I think Wilson is a great president, maybe the greatest ever."
"How can you say that? He's dangerously close to getting us involved in a European war."
Rosa's attitude was common among ethnic Germans, who naturally saw the German side of the story, and among left-wingers, who wanted to see the Tsar defeated. However, plenty of people who were neither German nor left-wing took the same view. Gus replied carefully, "When German submarines are killing American citizens, the president can't..." He was about to say, "turn a blind eye." He hesitated, flushed, and said, "can't ignore it." She did not seem to notice his embarrassment. "But the British are blockading German ports, in violation of international law, and German women and children are starving as a result. Meanwhile, the war in France is at a stalemate. Neither side has changed its position by more than a few yards for the last 6 months. The Germans have to sink British ships, otherwise they lose the war." She had an impressive grasp of the complexities. That was why Gus always enjoyed talking to her. "I studied international law," he said. "Strictly speaking, the British aren't acting illegally. Naval blockades were banned by the Declaration of London of 1909, but that was never ratified." She was not so easily sidetracked. "Never mind the legalities. The Germans warned Americans not to travel on British liners. They put an advertisement in the papers, for goodness sake. What else can they do? Imagine that we were at war with Mexico, and the Lusitania had been a Mexican ship carrying